Welcome to the Sacred Body Podcast with Stacey Ramsauer. I am your host, Stacey, and I believe that the body is a space of reverence. Whether you were talking about your body of flesh and bones that house your soul, spirit, or the body of the earth, even your body of work, I believe the body is a space of sacred connection and reflection. Until we have the capacity, the tools, the language, to relate to our body and express ourselves with ease and authenticity, our relationships and our experience of belonging here to this earth and to each other will be fractured. On this podcast, we explore the dynamics of light and darkness, pleasure and pain, and even comfort living in our own skin. I hope you enjoy. Welcome, everybody, to the Sacred Body Podcast. I'm thrilled to be here today with Dr. Scott Blossom. You have such a wealth of experience and education behind you, Scott, and I'm just going to read a brief bit of your bio from your website, but then I would love for you to also introduce yourself. Scott has integrated traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, yoga somatics, and evidence-based nutrition into his clinical practice and educational offerings for more than 25 years. I learned about you, Scott, from Pam Johnson in Houston, Texas. I know that there was you've been teaching and working for so long, but you've been on my radar for quite a long time, although I've never studied with you directly. Your presence on social media in the ways that that tool does work has been such a gift for me. The way you share your wisdom through your clinical nuggets, I love so much. And I have experienced you as someone with a diverse experience who's really lived the practice, lived the teachings, and you share with such love. And that is what drew me to you in terms of coming on the podcast today. I'm particularly interested in some things I've heard you say about the microbiome, and that's what we'll dive into to start at least. But I welcome you here. I'm so grateful. And I would love for you to introduce yourself, what's arising in the moment.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. And thank you for such a that was a very loving introduction. Mm-hmm. Welcome. You know, I really appreciate it. And so my background, I have a biology degree. I studied both traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and started my career actually working in death and dying settings. I worked with the Cancer Center in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And helped to integrate their program with both acupuncture and yoga. Started working with the Hospice of Santa Barbara and taking actually interns from the school that I went to. We would take four interns out to treat basically whole families, you know, because when someone's dying, people come around and the caregivers, it can be, you know, it's so taxing. So we would treat actually, you know, everybody in the house. And we would only come if the caregivers would agree to receive treatment as well. It wasn't focused on the patient. It was focused on, you know, the whole scenario. And so those were ways that I, you know, initially got inspired, but my, you know, kind of my integrative inspiration really came in college, and it's continued to this day. I sometimes tell patients, I'm a total hippie. I'm a surfer. I love yoga. I love natural foods. I love all that stuff, but I'm like a science-y hippie rather than a woo hippie. I love evidence-based nutrition, and I really do love, you know, seeing how science elucidates the things that are you know, coming out. And with our subject today being microbiome oriented, that to me is you know, one of the richest places, because it's not just touching on the ways that science can help us see our world differently. In really important ways, it's bringing us back to what you could call more of a kind of animist view that you see in tantric yoga, that you see in indigenous traditions, of where you recognize that the hidden forces, and in this case, the microscopic bacteria and things that live in you and are absolutely essential to your survival, are things that it's not that you you're in a kind of relationship that is, it's family. You don't have a choice about servicing that relationship. And so then something like prayer or ritual that kind of connects you to your sense of relationship in the world is, you know, is not a far cry anymore. So I think it's easier for folks who have maybe more, you know, mainstream backgrounds or, you know, specific religious backgrounds can maybe start to appreciate, you know, how these practices that seem esoteric in these medical traditions like traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, which have been my wheelhouse, are actually articulating a valid, you know, view of reality and something that's essential if we're going to really understand and incorporate these rising insights that are coming out of science, especially from places like microbiome research.
That's fascinating. The clarity with which you just painted that picture is really moving to me. I wonder how you balance the interplay of, you know, it's like the science and the sacred, but specifically someone who sort of gets turned on by research and evidence-based structures is what I heard you say, balancing that with intuition. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm in graduate school, and this is a selfish question. I'm in graduate school and I'm struggling a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. You're having the submarine sandwich of words at the moment.
Yes. Oh gosh. Yeah. Ah, yeah. Just trying to ingest as much as possible. And yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, just to kind of put a basis on that, one of the most intuitive processes I think that everybody can relate to is like, you know, feeling full after a meal or not feeling like you ate enough or feeling like you ate too much. Like, where are you getting that from? It's not being reported from your, you know, your data device that's measuring, you know, you can get that kind of information. You're sensing it, and you could say it's intuitive because it has that quality of being fluid. And that, you know, along those lines, like with grad school, the grad school analogy is going to grad school is always going to produce indigestion. You know, and again, especially when you go to grad school in a more liberal arts kind of westernized approach to graduate level studies, there's a bias towards valuing the word and valuing, you know, quantity of knowledge. And, you know, there's certain things that are just part of the kind of like occupational hazard of being a student, especially at that level. And the good news is you're kind of at some level, hopefully paying your dues to get this massively comprehensive vision that you touch into. And then when you come out, you can come back to following your passions and getting into the niche that's like really the thing that's going to be, you know, what you love doing within the field or the discipline that you're studying. And so along those lines, I feel like yoga practices especially, somatic practices especially, but really any of the yoga practices, meaning all the way from you know, sort of jnana yoga and sort of philosophy and discernment kind of practices, meditation, mantra, they're all speaking to the cultivation of intuition. And one way that is interesting in Sanskrit is that intuition, the term that sometimes can be used for it is sankalpa, which also can mean intention. But sankalpa actually means that you take something and you understand it in its wholeness. You don't analyze, because analysis and intuition go kind of hand in hand. Like, you need to be able to be analytical. And obviously Western science and the whole Western method, you could say, is heavy and biased toward analysis being the strongest basis for deriving knowledge. And then other you know, practices and traditions will be heavier on the side of global knowledge, or trying to, you know, again, something like philosophy, where you're taking these giant questions and sort of sitting with them, or meditation, where you're trying to be with the totality of your experience in the present moment, that we naturally have to switch back and forth during our day. And so you happen to be in a season where you're being dominated by that analytical, the vikalpa is a term in Sanskrit, the vikalpa kind of mode is dominant for you at the moment. And that has its own rigor and indigestibility when it's really intense, in the same way that folks that only work on the intuitive side will often find themselves being swamped by the bigness and overwhelmed by the, you know, the subjectivity of it in a certain way that is, So I think, you know, my kind of comment on that is that I do believe that Western traditions, especially in the old day when you were learning an art, you know, the science of something hopefully yields the art, and the art is where the intuition gets to flourish again. And so you're kind of in this egg of, you're getting all that kind of download so that your intuition can start to be more part of the equation when you get through the process.
Yeah, the left brain, right brain aspect of it. And this, I'm reflecting on when, you know, the early days of learning, studying yoga intensively, and then also studying yoga in order to be able to teach it, and like the rigor of it, and then through practice and just like letting it move through my body and let it take its natural shape, and that more observational quality versus analytical. And so it's difficult for me to be in the purely analytical phase where it's not quite flowing, but you know, I can even reflect on my own lived experience, and it's a matter of time, and it is a matter of intention too. And I'm reflecting on the fact that you're a surfer, and these sort of like more embodied intuitive ways that you engage life that I imagine support your capacity for reading the research and doing the analysis.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if I can give you some unsolicited advice,
please.
Because even Chinese medical school had that quality. It was an overwhelming amount of information. And when I was in biology, getting my biology degree, I didn't do this, but in Chinese medical school, I did do this. And it was, I would carry my books with me, and I would literally do five minute like study bites, because I had gotten hip to the concept of the digestive fire is overwhelmed. It's being weakened if I try to eat too much at once. So it kind of changed the way I moved through the day, because I would constantly be going into, I was a student, so I was only working part-time, and I, you know, I had certain amount of time in my day. And instead of like, I'm going to sit down and do it for 2 hours, I would kind of drop into subjects and for 5 minutes at a time, and just take a very discrete piece of that and then hold it. And that was especially true with Chinese herbalism, because their pharmacopoeia is massive. And that was actually how that yielded the best retention and the best digestion of some extremely vast subjects.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. And it feels, I'm going to work it a little bit, but it also does feel like an appropriate segue into this conversation about the microbiome. And there's one piece that I think is worth touching on, which is in our culture, there's a lot of all or nothing. Like, we're such a sort of extremist culture where, you know, if a supplement is good, then we have to take a lot of it, massive amounts of it. If we decide that one thing is helpful, then we just sort of overload on it. And in the same way, if we get off track, it's like, oh, well, whatever. Now I'm off track. Now I'm just going to go hard into my hedonism or whatever it is. How do you see this sort of facet of our culture having an impact on the microbiome? And of course, in there, like, just for the sake of saying it, what is the microbiome and why does it matter?
Yeah. Okay. Great. Great. That's such an interesting question. And so I'll start with just that simple definition for folks that are more, you know, just orienting to what the microbiome is it's the community of bacteria, fungi, viruses, and then sort of some very specific forms called archaea that live in and on us and have their biggest concentration in our digestive gut, you know, our large intestine, but they also live everywhere else, including your entire digestive tract and your sinuses, your mouth, all over your skin. You know, there's, yeah. So the microbiome is that community. And we have a symbiotic relationship with all those organisms. And so much so that it is proven that we delegate essential functions to the microbiome. Like, so without those, that symbiotic relationship with, because some people that have had really specific diseases are born with an immune system where they have tried to keep them completely free of bacteria. So these would be babies that were then isolated in a way to not allow any bacteria into their system, and they don't survive. You know, it's not a survivable situation because of the essentiality of what the microbiome does for us. And, you know, it's things like the microbiome, it's not your immune system. It's sort of like the educator for your immune system. So yes, you have a human immune response, but that human immune response is being modulated all the time. You know, you're going through situations where you're exposed to germs or viruses or polluted air, or polluted water, or whatever the situation might be, or cold air, you know, whatever the environmental impact might be that you experience, your system gets to decide how big of an issue is this and how much do I have to, you know, turn my immune system on. And it's actually the microbiome that's informing that modulation. So the immune system itself is actually going to lack in it the necessary intelligence to have a proper response without the microbiome. And this is actually what we see now a lot with, you know, some of the patterning around diseases that are really prevalent, including autoimmune disorders, is that if the microbiome is disturbed enough, then the person's immune system is deeply, deeply dysregulated. And what can happen is the immune system either will be under-responsive, but more likely it's going to be over-responsive, or it's going to respond in ways that are not appropriate or commensurate to what it's trying to deal with. And this is just one example, because as we're going to talk about, the astrobilome is a term that has to do, and it sounds like a conjunction between estrogen, and it's like astrobilome is the microbiome that isn't actually just specific to estrogen. It actually is specific to all reproductive hormones. But this is another great example of this being like a regulating system. It's a master system inside of the body for influencing the reproductive hormonal balances and, you know, your health reproductively. Also things like blood sugar, weight, appetite, cardiovascular health, lung health, brain health, mood, you know, it just goes on and on. So that's like a kind of simple, you know, definition of the microbiome for us to kind of, you know, rest on. And, you know, to the comment about people being excessive today, you know, I think that there is an attitude that pervades an older view, and this is something, again, I can go on and on about, but I'm going to keep it really short, is that as science in the last 100 years developed some extremely powerful things like antibiotics, genetic medicine, that had such a massive impact, like on people being able to survive, you know, literally. In 100 years, we extended the lifespan of the average person by 25 years in just a century. So I can understand how when they started to discover these things, they thought, oh my goodness, All we need to do is find the right drugs, concentrate them to get the job done, and we'll go in like a laser, and we'll take care of things that need to be, you know, fixed, and then people will move forth in really optimal health. But what we're finding now is that even with all of that, we're actually dying younger now. You know, it's the first time in history where more people are dying from non-infectious diseases. We're dying from preventable diseases, and the lifespan is shortening again. So those things were not simply the answer. They were an incredible piece of, like you could say, emergency medicine, and they have, and then they absolutely have a place in things. But this whole kind of idea of moderation, and how if somebody thinks, okay, I need to find the active ingredient, and then if a little bit is good, more must be better. That's like a very new idea. That was never a prevalent idea, because just coming back to the original thing I said about digestion, everybody knows there's a right amount to eat at every meal. And you don't know exactly what that is. You have to judge how your body feels and what your capacity is. But there's always knowing when to say when, and that this idea about concentrating, isolating, all of that stuff goes along with a very Western medical kind of philosophy to life, which in certain cases, when you're trying to save someone's life with an antibiotic or a steroid hormone, yes, then that is probably the case. But you have to be, you know, but in normal everyday life, it's actually usually something because of its extremity that leads to imbalance or injury, or even, you know, could be, you know, take somebody into death because you overdo it so much.
I don't know that I've heard anyone name explicitly that, you know, certainly I know that the advent of antibiotics made, you know, life on planet Earth a whole different ball game, but that our lifespan is now decreasing again, and having to reckon with the reasons for that, the various causes. It's so fascinating to me, and we could take this conversation in a multitude of directions, but being that we're focused on the microbiome, I have a particular interest in the microbiome and its impact on reproductive health, specifically pregnancy, pregnancy outcomes, the intervention of antibiotics during pregnancy and labor, and then of course, postpartum recovery and ongoing health of children. In the next 30 minutes, Scott, do your best.
Just so you know.
Yeah. But can you, I mean, maybe we'll just jump into that place. Like everyone, the microbiome is a human fact. And can you just give us a little more understanding of how it is of particular interest for reproductive health, the role it plays in reproductive health?
Sure. You know, it's making me think too. I want to give credit where credit's due. I don't know if you're aware of this. There's an organization, I think it's called Microbiome Birth.
No.
I follow them. Yeah. And so they're really cool, and they're always putting out new information. And so they're very deep on this. And so I
awesome. Want
to temper expectations, because I've studied it a bit and I have presented on this subject, but the folks, and you know, if I get a second, I'll try to find them on their email list. So I'll try to find their, you know, their info before we stop and share that, because I think they're doing really great work for, you know, for pregnant folks.
Thank you.
And, yeah. And yeah, so the microbiome goes through some really profound changes in the arc of a pregnancy. And what's really interesting is that, to me, is that for the one thing, there's not a sort of, you know, there's no uniformity of the microbiome from person to person exactly. And that there's a number of factors that make that the case. And so this is where, for somebody like me who has a science background, but also uses traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda to work with patients, something like an Ayurvedic viewpoint of your dosha type, you know, your constitution, and that, oh, if you have more of this kind of, you know, constitutional proclivity with a certain dosha, you might do better eating along these lines, X, Y, and Z. This is very much a kind of reflection of the same principle there, is that if somebody's in robust health, that is a reflection that their gut is in robust health. Like, it's impossible to be in robust health without having a gut that's in robust health, because again, it's the basis for it. It's not even, it has to start there at some level. And so this is where the good news for people who aren't, you know, nerdy microbiome folks, or they're not studying Ayurveda academically, is, and it comes back to the question about intuition. It's like learning the practices and the dietary things that make you feel your best is your intuitive way to go towards getting a healthy microbiome. And so when you start a pregnancy, that's ideally the place that you're at, because there's going to be some changes, and I can jump into that next, that determine that. There's changes in the microbiome through the arc of the pregnancy, and I can go into that more, but does that kind of give you a good starting point?
Yeah, I would love to hear you, before we jump into the changes during pregnancy, how does the microbiome impact fertility, for example? Is there a relationship there?
Yeah, and so this comes back to the term I mentioned, the estrobilome, E-S-T-R-O-B-O-L-O-M-E. And so there is a growing, the research is just really, really nascent, you know. So from a science perspective, there's some very interesting things that we can say. But at the same time, the simplest statement is the microbiome directly impacts hormonal health for somebody who may want, you know, who feels like they want to promote fertility because they want to become pregnant, or they want, you know, them and their partner, everybody wants to be in their best, most fertile space to start attempting to become pregnant, that gut health is as important. It's like you could start there as your first step, and that would be an absolutely wise thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so just a couple of other kind of details there, which is with the microbiome, the reproductive microbiome, you know, you're talking about the gut and the way that it's influencing those deeper hormone regulating patterns, but you're also talking about vaginal and penile microbiome and what are those things? And so I'll say a couple of things about that, is that the estrobilome, again, is your deep regulating influence. Other influences in the case of the penile microbiome is going to be circumcision, of course. In the case of, and then for across the board, is diet and lifestyle. And so those are huge. You know, those are huge, because lifestyle doesn't include just something like exercise. It includes sleep. It includes, emotional regulation and, you know, working with trauma. It includes how you work, where you work, your social environment. There's a really interesting, there's a kind of Venn diagram that I've seen where it includes, you know, at an individual level, things like genetics, also sexual practices, smoking, hygiene. It does turn out that, for lack of a better term, race does track along lines where Black folks will have different microbiota, and microbiota are the actual
bacteria. Organisms.
They're the organisms, yeah. That's right. And then at a relational level, of course, your sexual network, your social network, housing, your behavioral norms, you know, which could go along with, you know, sort of more mainstream heteronormative type of behavioral norms, as well as things that are not falling into that category. And then you also have community, which has to do, again, what's the environment that you live in? Do you live in an urban environment? Do you live in a natural environment? Do you live in a place where there is poverty and the kind of scarcity of nutrition and all the factors that go along with healthcare that go with poverty? what's the stress in your community, not just your personal stress, but what's the stress in your community. That will also affect the vaginal microbiome, the penile microbiome. And then lastly, at a societal level, things like racism, segregation, social policies, all of those kind of things are actually, they all have an impact. And what I think is interesting here, and I want to simplify this, is that, you know, the reproductive microbiomes are really a proxy for your gut microbiome. And your gut microbiome is influenced by your entire life, which is why you enlisted so many specific things that are going to impact that health. So again, for anybody who's like, oh my God, that's so many things. It's actually not, because they're actually just names for the milieu that you live in. All of your relationships, your personal relationship to yourself, your community, and then the larger societal, you know, influences.
I'm going to take just a little bit of a detour here to ask a question about, or to ask you to expound upon the difference between, you know, there's the impact of our environment on what we're actually able to ingest and the quality of those things that we're actually ingesting, but also the spirit in which those things are being ingested and our relationship to it. And I wonder if you could just parse that out a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that up, because what's interesting is that, you know, when we say grace before a meal, when we offer gratitude for a meal, no matter what it is, no matter what the food is. I remember being with my mentor in a situation where we were on the road and we had a long drive, like 3-4 hour drive, and it was already nighttime. So, and we had to be, we were super hungry. So we were trying to find some food, and all we could find was Coca-Cola and fried artichokes. Literally, we got to the place and it wasn't like fried artichokes being made for us. They were like, well, there's these fried artichokes that were the bottom of the barrel of their fried artichoke barrel. They're like, we're closing and we don't have anything for you, but we do have these fried artichokes and you can have a Coke. And I remember, like, in my mentor's, Dr. Bodha, who's an Ayurvedic teacher. And I remember thinking, wow, this is not going to work out well. You know, I was having my doubts or whatever. And to my surprise, he went on the most hysterical, like probably 5 to 10 minute, like, we got our stuff. He said yes. And I was like, okay, he's saying yes, so that means we're doing this. And so we get back into, we couldn't even eat in the restaurant. We had to eat in the car. So we get in the car and he just goes into this thing of praising the Coca-Cola. Wow, look at these beautiful artichokes and the breadcrumbs and the glistening, you know, like 3-hour-old oil. And like, he was acknowledging the, like, kind of just whatever the situation was, but he just went on and on about how it was going to be so good and we were going to feel incredible. And sure enough, we're laughing so hard by the end of it that basically we did feel great from that, but we ate it. And I swear I had an experience where I was like, wait a minute. He just somehow put like a spell on this meal and we both do feel fine. And we're able to, like, you know, we had a really, you know, good trip home. But so really my point is that the bugs are listening, and you could say your humanness with your macro senses, you know, eyes, ears, nose, skin, you know, et cetera, your macro senses, their primary function evolutionarily is to inform you about safety. Am I safe? And so it's the same thing. So when you praise a meal, when you praise the things that you're taking, no matter what it is, you're actually sending cues of safety to the microbiome. And actually, when you look at the vagus nerve and the way it's innervated, you know, the whole parasympathetic, you know, rest and digest, relax nervous system, 80% of those fibers come from the gut to the brain. Yeah. So actually, when the brain informs the gut that everything's good on the outside, the gut will say, great, thank you for the information. And it'll start sending out it'll start actually bolstering the wellness that comes when you do feel safe. So there's that relationship. And then on the other side, you know, it is really important to note that when we have food, the signaling, we can kind of digest things that don't quite suit us as long as we're not allergic to them. Uh-huh. But if something's not quite right for us, we can get away with it for a little while because our body has a little bit of buffering that it can do. But it's really over the long term. It's the long-term lifestyle and diet patterns that are going to set up that healthy microbiome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that story. That was wonderful.
Well, and you know, I'm going to add one more thing is that one of the factors that really influences reproductive microbiome also is antibiotic and then medications, especially medications mm-hmm. like acids and you know, SSRIs, which are medicines for depression, like Prozac, you know, reuptake inhibitors. Those have been documented to change the microbiome in meaningful ways and often in ways that are disturbing. But again, if you need them, then they're necessary, but they're also like, they're not designed necessarily to be taken forever, you know,
right.
It's a stopgap to get you through something. And it's like harm reduction, you know, go ahead and do it while you need to, and then try to transition to where you're, you know, having a diet that is, you know, free of those kind of meds.
Yeah. And I hold the medical system accountable for their lack of acknowledgement about the implications of certain medications, because I think there's a time and a place, and there's also like, and this is going to have an impact here, and so here's how we might mitigate some of the harm, which I don't think that's happening enough. That goes back to the like all or nothing. It's sort of like, this is fine, you can take this, this is safe to take during whatever, with no real consideration of the complexity, the nuance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. A good example of that is that antacids, if you look in the physician's desk reference, antacids are meant only be taken for 2 weeks at a time maximum.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the messaging won't be either clear enough or coming at all from the, you know, the Western medical provider, that after 2 weeks, the reason it's only considered appropriate for 2 weeks is that the acids do not simply just play a role in digesting food. They're part of how you actually assimilate, and they play secondary roles in the system, where if you're constantly suppressing it, it has a downside effect that will accrue over time, and that is not favorable.
Hmm. Again, I want to go in lots of different directions with you. I'm curious if you want to step out on this edge with me, speaking about the spirit in which we take in, you know, things and how that impacts our gut health, the impact of the penile and vaginal microbiome, and like the spirit in which we're engaging our sexuality and our sexual relationships. Mm-hmm. And how can you go into more detail about, like, how do our emotions or stress level perception of safety actually impact the biological?
Yeah.
You know, that's a bit complex, but.
Yeah. There's a simple way, you know, there's a complex way and a more simple way to talk about it. So I'll give more of a simple, you know, reflection on that, which is just that there is documented evidence that if somebody is under chronic stress, that will change their microbiome makeup. Mm-hmm. And it will start to favor pathogenic bacteria. And this goes back to also the food example, because in the same way, if somebody's eating food that's loaded with additives or pesticides or, you know, things that the body are poisonous to the body, it has the same impact, because it's a stress storm for the digestive tract. And so the microbiome is changing in ways.
Response.
Its response is going to look not entirely the same, but not entirely different between somebody who's experiencing emotional stress or lack of safety and intimacy with their partner over a period of time, as it'll look if a person is eating a diet that doesn't suit them. And one of the things that can happen with that is when the microbiome starts to change that way, it can start to influence some of the bacteria that that are called deconjugating bacteria. And so deconjugating bacteria are when your body is processing, and this is for everybody, when your body's processing estrogen, which is so important, of course, in reproductive health, when it's processing estrogen, the body needs a cycle. It needs to actually have it be active. Then it packages it up to move it out of the body. But because estrogen is a steroid hormone, those forms that are packaged to be removed from the body, if they do not leave in a timely manner, they will come back in. And when they come back in, they're actually in a form that is highly, highly, you know, carcinogenic, actually, cancer-causing. Wow. So you don't want, you want, once the body packages the estrogens to be eliminated, they need to be eliminated. That's the goal. And so if these deconjugating bacteria, if their levels of activity, and that could also happen, you know, could change if their population size changes or it gets, you know, interrupted or adjusted in a negative way. If their activity is too high, which is how they'll act when certain kinds of, you know, stresses, both, should you could say, socially or dietarily, when those stresses are in place, if the population shifts so that the activity of these deconjugating bacteria is high, then what happens is those estrogens do not get eliminated. They come back in, they get reabsorbed in the intestines. And then that creates lots of problems, including the potential for very serious things like cancers. And then, but, you know, and then if those act, those deconjugating bacteria, you know, if their activity is low, then the body is able to excrete the conjugated estrogens out through the bowel, you know, with you know, in the feces.
In the way that some of our supplementation or like use of pharmaceuticals negatively impacts the microbiome, are there ways, like, can supplementation also be reparative? And what is, what might that look like? In addition to, of course, an appropriate diet, I'm just imagining, you know, circumstances like you articulated before, there are circumstances where there aren't a lot of options for someone's diet to change, in which case, what's the best approach?
Right. Yeah. So when you know, the scenario is such, the body will of course do its best to adapt. So when, you know, if the external environment is stressful, if the food environment is stressful, you know, and often that goes along with lack of high quality food, et cetera, then, you know, a large part of it comes from learning things about self-regulation, you know, because it is, you know, the you know, regulating the nervous system does have a very big impact on gut health. And there are some, but the fact is that there are some very, you know, inexpensive and simple things that you can do to promote these, like to promote the activity of, you know, the, well, to promote the levels of certain enzymes that are produced in the estrobilome to help make the estrogen cycle, for example, really work properly. And it includes things like beans. Eating more beans is, you know, demonstrably important. And in fact, in certain, you know, there's data about the like in Latino culture, they eat the most beans. They eat something like five times more beans than any other segment of the American population. And they have disproportionately good health outcomes. And there's been 20 years of investigating why this is, and they've come up with it actually to say, and mean like, must be the genes, it must be, you know, something else. And they're actually saying that the beans play a huge role in that. And one of the ways that works is actually to set up the reproductive microbiome. Wow. Another thing that's simple is something like foods that are rich in beta-glucan, which is a kind of fiber, and that's something like nutritional yeast, which is very inexpensive and easy to add to foods. And it's a, you know, a B complex, and it has proteins, and it has, it's a complete food, and you don't need to use very much of it to get its benefit. It also is an excellent regulator of blood sugar. And so things like whole grains and nutritional yeast. And again, nowadays, some people are very sensitive around grains. And if you can't digest a food, I'm not advocating that you try to force yourself to digest something that you don't tolerate or are allergic to. I would never, you know, imply that. And then you have things like cruciferous vegetables, which is, you know, cabbage and cauliflower and collard greens and arugula and kale, et cetera, broccoli, all those kind of things. Those are also really important to regulating the estrobilome. Mm-hmm. And so if a person can include more of those in their diet, and all these things are whole foods. So, you know, if you buy beans and you make them yourself, that's actually the safest and healthiest way to make them. That's by far the least expensive form of getting mm-hmm. it. And then, you know, pectin-rich foods like apples. And fruits in general are also good for regulating estrobilome. And then on the flip side, those are some ideas of like things that you can do, but then there's all the things that you are good to avoid, which would be avoid processed foods, overeating mm-hmm. sugar, alcohol, smoking, unnecessary antibiotic, you know, prescription and use, and also a diet that's really high, too high in fats. And that's not to say you shouldn't eat enough fat, but I'm talking about like when you're having foods that are like desserts where it's, you know, a fat sugar bomb kind of thing, or you're having foods that are prepared in really like, you know, low quality oils or have really low quality oils added to them to make them fatty.
Thank you. In the interest of our time together, I do want to get specifically to changes during pregnancy and the impact of the microbiome on our babies. So could you please talk about how the microbiome changes during pregnancy? That's something I'm really eager to hear about.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. This is one of the most interesting and surprising things, you know, in the research that I did for me, which was that you know, you start with your normal microbiome, then you become pregnant. And then it's like in the second trimester, the microbiome actually starts to become less diverse. And this is, you can have the, you know, seemingly the same diet, even though, you know, some of the interest in food often changes when somebody's pregnant. But during that second trimester, the microbiome becomes less diverse. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this, but it's something that not everybody may know. But when pregnant folks get sick during pregnancy, especially during the second trimester, they can sometimes, like, it will come on like a ton of bricks. Like, mm-hmm. they'll get way sicker than they usually do. And it actually has, in my opinion, something to do with this change in the microbiome just making your immune system less well regulated. And I don't know why the body would do that, but it does. And so there's something going on. And what's really interesting, so you kind of start with your normal microbiome, and then there's some changes with the whole cascade of the first trimester hormones, but then the second trimester is when this really dramatic loss of diversity takes place, meaning you have less diverse microbiome, less diverse species of bacteria from what you normally have. But then, and that kind of goes through second and third trimester. And then about a month before birth, the whole thing starts to get more diverse again. So it's literally prepping itself for, you know, ideally a vaginal birth, because then the child is going to literally be bathed in that microbiome. So the body sort of does this very intentional thing of getting less diverse. And then in the last month before delivery, it starts getting more diverse again. And it's at a really like kind of its maximum diversity right before birth, which is excellent, again, for imparting as much of a diverse microbiome as possible to the baby on the way out. And the reason I keep using the word diverse is that is, if you want a one-word definition of a healthy microbiome, is it's a diverse microbiome, meaning the different species of microorganisms. And much in the same way that a healthy forest, any kind of ecosystem that you go into that's a natural space, when it's, you know, the diversity in those spaces is its strength. And that's exactly the same principle with the microbiome. And so now, you know, naturally we're leading up to kind of like, what's the difference between vaginal birth and cesarean sex? Mm-hmm. Locations there. Well, and I should add, you know, one thing that's being tracked now very closely is group B streptococcus.
Yeah.
And so this is something.
I have my own personal story with GBS. Do. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to hear it. Do you want to offer that up?
Yeah. So in my first pregnancy, or I should say my first long-term pregnancy, I had a loss that was my first pregnancy. So about week 37 of my pregnancy with my son, I tested positive for GBS. And I didn't know much about it. I had been a doula, but my role as a doula hadn't really incorporated that too much. I had never heard it as like a life-threatening issue. Yeah. And my midwife got like extremely stressed out by it and told me that I needed to test negative for GBS in order to have a home birth. Wow. And so she put me on antibiotic protocol, and I am really wary of antibiotics in general. I haven't taken them in years. Long story short, I wanted a home birth, and I went into sort of a trauma response in this moment and was like, whatever you say, I'll do whatever you say, because I am not going to the hospital. Well, I tested positive again, and I got a yeast infection. And so she transferred my care to the hospital. And at the hospital, I distinctly remember, you know, they did an ultrasound without my permission. The OB told me it was a good thing that I was there, because the last thing anybody wants is a dead baby. And GBS was, you know, going to be this massively life-threatening thing. And somehow in there, my trauma response of just fawning and going along with it transformed to fuck all of you. This isn't right. Yeah. I'm not having my baby here this way. And I got a new midwife, and I started doing my own health protocol to try and rebuild what had been lost by taking this round of antibiotics. And I was given options and information and education about the implications of testing positive for GBS versus being infected, having an active infection. Yes. And what the risks were. And I was given the dignity of making a choice. And my choice was, I'm not taking antibiotics during labor unless there is evidence that I have an infection.
Yeah.
There are very clear signs that would indicate that there's a problem. Yeah. My labor was really fast. My son was almost born in the call. My bag burst right before he came out. There was no issue whatsoever. Mm. And in my second pregnancy, I opted not to even test. I just took very good care of my gut, and everybody's fine. And I think that there's too little talk about like agency and the power, just what you were speaking about, you know, saying grace over a meal. And we talk to our microbiome, and our microbiome is listening. Our body is listening. And there's a lot of gray area in there. The difference between testing positive for GBS and having an active infection, which is the threat.
Yeah.
So that's my story. I feel very passionate about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Wow. Wow. What an amazing story. You know, I think there's so many there's so many lessons and points that you just, you know, expressed in the telling. So thank you for, you know, all of that. And that's been my experience too, is that, like, I think the way that you said, being given the dignity to make your own choice and really saying, what are the stats? You know, what is, because in Europe, there's a very different, you know,
approach
word. Yeah. And whereas here, like, you know, that whole idea of going into, again, it's an extreme thing to tell a pregnant delivering person that good thing you're here so you don't have a dead baby. That's just awful.
That's like, you know, now my whole orientation to going into labor is like, yeah. I mean, it was so unnecessary. And
yeah, especially again, if it was like a super high risk thing, like it was, oh yeah, yes, if this is present, then 8 out of 10 times the baby dies. Sure.
Of but course.
It's not, it's something more like 1 in 20, you know, it's like,
yeah.
And even like you said, then you have to get into the fine distinctions between whether you have an infection or it's just present. Because the fact is, and this is one of the good things about the microbiome research, is that things like Strep B live in us.
And they're right, they're transient. Healthy,
they're kept in check. And there was something called quorum sensing that, you know, was a big biological discovery a few years ago, which is, again, when the environment favors a certain pathogenic bacteria, it isn't until they get to a big enough population that they switch over into their pathogenic expression.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's called quorum sensing, like Q-U-O-R-U-M. Yeah. And then, so again, basically it's like, oh, we got a quorum, let's take over the universe, you know, and then they turn into bad guys. And so this is very much what you were describing in your story, is that if they're in right relationship, which brings us back to, like, and again, an old concept, you know, an indigenous concept, if they're in right relationship in the microbiome, everything's, the context is healthy. So then those bacteria are behaving really, really differently than if they become hyperpopulated and go into their pathogenic expression. So yeah, I think you know, thank you again. And I just wanted to kind of amplify some of the things I heard you saying in there that I think are so important. Because again, especially from my seat as a practitioner, I don't comment on what Western medical practitioners do, or try to tell anybody to not listen to their Western medical practitioner. And at the same time, I do feel like when we look at what are the norms in Europe, and you can look at real data about birth outcomes, yeah, and you can say, oh, they're taking this attitude and this perspective on it, and in America they're taking this attitude and this perspective, so then you get the dignity to be part of the process of choosing how you want to go, you know, if somebody's, you know. And so I think that's the big thing, is to give that respect and the dignity to the birthing person
and how that impacts birth outcomes and the health of the baby, and potentially any repair work that does need to be done.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if my dignity is intact, that's a whole different recovery than if I've been, like, guided by fear through the whole process.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Well, and this brings two things up, because I'm going to kind of track us back in. It's like, one thing for pregnant people, it turns out that your oral microbiome, mm-hmm, has a bigger impact on the vaginal microbiome than in terms of population. There's more similarity of the types of bacteria. And it's partly, if you think about it, there's a similarity where there's a certain amount of exposure to the external environment that, yeah, the gut doesn't have. The digestive gut, the large intestine, is largely oxygen free, whereas, yeah, the vaginal microbiome, the oral microbiome, have a certain amount of oxygen coming in. So there's a different population there. So if somebody wants to focus on kind of their overall health, keeping your oral health really good during pregnancy is helpful. So that's, mm-hmm, it's a side note. And I also just want to comment on, you know, with cesarean, the good news from the research that I've seen is that while they're the child doesn't come out with as robust of a microbiome, it's usually within months, just a, yeah, few months, that the child's microbiome will populate, so that, you know, you could have two babies living in the same house, and one was cesarean and the other one was vaginally delivered, and they're going to end up looking fairly similar, you know, if they're both having, you know, comparable experiences, like they're both having breast milk, et cetera, they're going to have the diversity of their microbiome will develop for them relatively equally. And when I say diversity, they'll have different microbiomes. It's like a fingerprint. They're all both going to have their unique microbiome, but the diversity levels will be similar. Whereas right after cesarean, the baby that comes out cesarean tends to have a much less diverse microbiome.
Yeah.
Simply because going through the vaginal canal is a process of literally injecting the microbiome into all of the orifices of the child, which as an evolutionary thing is protective. You know, it is
a, yes.
a protective experience. So those the new ones that come in that are cesarean, you know, delivered, it's worthwhile to, you know, I'm a fan of the vaginal swab, you know, that's a great, like, you know, kind of fix if they can, if the doctors that they're being delivered by will be willing to do that. And then secondarily, just be aware that for those first couple of months, you want to be maybe a little more careful because your baby is a little more vulnerable without having such a diverse microbiome. But that's also where, you know, breast milk is a miracle.
Yeah.
And so basically you do the normal things, keep their environment relatively clean, keep, you know, the breast milk flowing so that they can gradually come into the world they live in. And of course, if you have pets who want to welcome the new one to the world, that's great because that also really directly impacts the diversity of their microbiome. So I really want to dissuade folks who have cesarean births from taking my comments as meaning you should get out the Lysol and keep the room sterile, you know, like basically just keep it, you know, the temperature well in the room, you know, normally clean, but have the new one meet everybody that's in the house and be exposed, you know, so because you're all sharing a big microbiome anyway.
And lots of skin on skin. The benefit of skin on skin is that our skin carries the microbiome too.
Yeah, it does.
I could sit and talk to you for hours and hours. I do hope you'll come back. I would love to have you back to expand upon this because I'd love to talk about autoimmune issues.
Okay.
That's a big one. And yeah, you've fed me so much. It's just a pleasure to be with you to share time and space. And would you please let people listening know what you're up to, where they can find you, and how you would like to be contacted?
Thank you. I had a great time. My website is Dr. Blossom spelled out, D-O-C-T-O-R, blossom.com. And what I do, just as you read in your intro about me, is I specialize in courses that bring in what you could call traditional knowledge and wisdom, like yoga and Ayurveda type practices. And then I integrate with modern, mostly evidence-based nutrition, a lot of about microbiome health as well as, but I, you know, as I cultivate, you know, the different subjects that I do, it's very much a kind of, it's what I practice and what I teach online, especially is I try to educate people in a way that is, it's broad in the sense of it's essential to have good movement. It's also essential to think about food. So I don't zero in on one thing only. I always present things in a way where I'm saying, this is how your psychological, you know, neurological is going to impact, you know, something like, say, your digestive fire or your reproductive health or your heart or your brain. And then this is how your behavior, your lifestyle, your exercise, et cetera. And I always present that way. So if people are interested, that's what I'm passionate about. And I'm continuing to offer up new things. And so you can come visit me at the website.
Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I really appreciated it.